Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, making science and technology accessible, understandable, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Today in the program, we'll speak with Adam Rogers. He's the author of the book Proof, The Science of Booze. Humans have been perfecting the science of alcohol production for 10,000 years, but modern scientists are only just beginning to distill the complex reactions behind the perfect buzz. Rogers joins us to frame our alcoholic history literally under a microscope.
Good morning, Lynn. And then we're going to have a conversation about that dizzying experience we call chemistry. You know, the chemistry is the one that you find in another person, and it's not that kind of chemistry, you know, the romantic stuff. It's about finding the essence of innovation in creative pairs. Think Trey Parkinson, Matt Stone, Lennon McCartney, Jobs and Woz. We'll speak with Joshua Schenck, who writes on the subject in the book, Powers of Two.
All that plus today's cool story when we return. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule building at 350 Main Street and serves contemporary American cuisine with a summer menu including produce from their urban garden, open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, Rich Fine Realtor, and Rail Resorts.
The second annual Seco Block Master Series Climbing Competition returns to the Utah Olympic Park August 7th and 8th. Climbers will compete head-to-head on the 50-foot wall overhanging the Olympic Aerials Pool. For local climbers, the competition wall is open daily for public climbing from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Event and climbing wall info available at utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with John Wells. From our ancestors' accidental discovery of fermented drinks to the cutting-edge laboratory research that proves why, or even if, people actually like the stuff. From fermentation to distillation to aging, our next guest, Adam Rogers, offers a unique glimpse inside the barrels, the stills, the tanks, and the casks that produce these iconic drinks. In his book, Proof, The Science of Booze, he uncovers alcohol's deepest mysteries, chasing the physics, the molecular biology, organic chemistry, and even metallurgy that power alcohol production. He explores the subtle mixture of psychology and neurobiology that fuels our taste for all these products. Adam Rogers, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. That was such a nice introduction of the book. I feel like I'm going to be superfluous now. You guys went through it already.
Oh, not at all, because there's just so much in your book. And what a fun book. You know, as we say, for 10,000 years, we have been fermenting. So take us back to those earliest days.
Well, you know, it's a really tantalizing scientific mystery, historical mystery, archaeological mystery, to know who the first human was to figure out, hey, you know, this weird thing that happens to fruit or happens to honey or happens to any other source of sugar around us, you know, it actually makes it taste good and it makes me feel different when we consume it. But the oldest evidence of human beings controlling, taming this process, this natural process, fermentation, yeast eating sugar and making ethanol, the alcohol we drink, and carbon dioxide. The oldest evidence so far is about 9 or 10,000 years old. It comes from an archaeological site in China called Jiahu, which is a really interesting site because it's also a place where some of the oldest musical instruments have been found, some of the oldest written language have been found, some of the oldest instances of people eating rice. So it's a super old, it's a cradle of human civilization. And there's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania named Pat McGovern who got hold of a fragment of a pot, a shard, and did a lot of analysis on some residue on that shard and found evidence of some fruit, hawthorn probably, which is like a chalky apple, rice, and also honey. Found beeswax, chemicals that you'd find in beeswax. If you mix those things together, you have a hard time keeping them from fermenting. They all really, yeast really love all that stuff, and they really like to eat it and make booze. So there's no way of knowing whether this was used for ritual or used for social purposes or part of a party. But McGovern makes a compelling argument that it was intentional, and it's the oldest artifact that we have of people intentionally making booze, making something to drink. It really is kind of the Mother Eve of all of our drinks, because of course honey is what is, you make into mead. Rice is the basis for a lot of the drinks from Asia, sake and shochu, stuff like that. And then the fruit is what you'd find you'd make wine or brandy out of. So this really this is the ancestor, I would say, the ancestor of everything that we drink today.
Adam, an interesting fact, and I don't know if it's hearsay, but I read this in your book about how it is thought that hunter-gatherers actually settled down and started growing crops for this very reason, with the incentive of, cooking up a little brew.
It's an argument that the anthropologists and archaeologists have. The controversy is known as the bread versus beer controversy. And the question is whether, when people, one of the hallmarks of civilization, as I say in the book, the thing that the moment that we go from being merely Homo sapiens to people, you know, is this moment when we settle down, when we, instead of wandering, we find a place where we can build a permanent settlement and have permanent crops, have row crops, and those crops were often, they were grains. And the question is, well, when we did that, was the incentive to make bread, to mill the grains into mm-hmm. flour and make bread, or to brew them into a beer? And some of them, I count myself among these folks, would say that the preponderance of evidence is that they wanted to make beer. They wanted to brew this drink. It was safer than drinking the water by itself because alcohol has some antimicrobial properties, so you'd kill off the spoilage bugs, and it made you feel good, and it tasted better than the other option. So there was a real incentive for people to tame this process, like I said, to domesticate it, to take fermentation, which is something that nature does without us. You know, a grape will ferment in the forest without anybody there to hear it, but it creates a product that we want. And so we grabbed hold of it. We taught the yeast to do what we wanted. In a weird way, they taught us. The yeast, this fungus, domesticated us because it wants sugar. It wants simple sugar to eat, and it taught us how to give it to it, so it could have a nice life too.
Adam, I have some friends of mine in Boston who have gone through all the different levels of classification and testing to be high-end sommeliers in various Boston restaurants.
That's anger, denial, acceptance, bargaining. Am I remembering? I'm probably confused that with something else. But yes, it's an incredibly complicated test. Sommeliers really go through the mill.
Yeah, they really do. And I sit down with these guys and this one girl, and we, you know, I try to have them show me some things, and I just can't smell and I just can't taste the stuff that they're coming up with. And I loved your book. You say research says that people cannot detect more than four separate aromas in any given drink.
Yeah, at a certain point, our brains are really good at systems integration, to steal a nerd term from tech out here in Silicon Valley. They're really good at integrating all that stuff. As far as people who study senses, smell, and taste can tell right now, and this is really complicated stuff, people don't really understand how all of that works yet. A couple of people who've done the most to elucidate how the sense of smell works won a Nobel Prize for that work. It's a big deal. But it does seem like when presented with something really complex, like a glass of wine, let's say, what our brains do is integrate. So the idea that you can come up with more than four separate aromas in it, and the aromas are really the complicated things that we would call in flavor. You know, the tongue, you probably know this, but the tongue only does salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami, that sort of meaty flavor, and maybe some other stuff going on in the mouth in terms of a mechanical perception of creaminess. There might be some other flavors as well, but really all the deep stuff, if I say to you strawberry or shoe polish or nail polish or dried apricot or tobacco, those are all things that I can evoke those aromas in your head immediately. I mean, I say those and you can smell them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when you start to integrate those into something that, let's say, a professional wine reviewer or sommelier or professional whiskey too. I mean, it's not just the wine folks who do this. It's all the sommeliers and professionals in any of the categories. They'll start to identify 12, 13, 15 different aromas. And that's something that that most of the research says people really can't do. Now, what sommeliers and folks who have that training are really good at is sense memory and having that vocabulary. So they can identify flavors and smells in sequence, and they can put words to them in ways that untrained professionals, or sorry, untrained amateurs, people like me, really in studies can't do.
Are also very good at gargling.
And, well, I'll tell you, it is a profession that rewards the ability to spit with some elegance.
I love that.
Can't drink all that stuff.
I love that. You know, I don't find that so much fascinating, but all the different gradients and all these different things that they, say that they can do. But what I find fascinating from your book is sort of the environment. Are you with these sorts of friends? Are you on the seashore? Are you with people? What's your mood? And that affects how the alcohol tastes, doesn't it?
Very much so. And it changes the effect that the alcohol has on you psychologically. In the book, I try to be open about this. I describe that as theater, the theater mm-hmm. of the moment. And I think it's really important. I don't mean to denigrate that. That feeling that many of us, if you're the kind of person who drinks wine, let's say, that feeling that you've had when you go to a really nice meal and you get a really nice bottle of wine and the sommelier makes a nice big deal out of it and you get the beautiful glasses and maybe they decant it and it's this little bistro that you found that nobody else knows about and it's just, you get this spectacular sensation when you drink it. It tastes wonderful. It makes you feel good. These are all things that are that are part of the experience. They are as authentic as any of the molecules in that glass that give it the flavor and smell that it has. But they will change. It will be different when you drink that glass of wine by yourself in front of a Star Trek rerun some night. You can trust me. I have some experience in that category. And that's because of something that in the world where there are people doing research on this, the effects of ethanol as a recreational drug, essentially, and wine, beer, the things that we drink, are really related to what they call expectancies, to what we have in our heads in terms of what we think will happen, what we've seen when we were kids from our parents if they drank, or what we see in the movies and on television. If we think that a drink is going to be delicious, then we tend to experience it as delicious. Here's a mean trick that you can play on your friends. If you give them a taste of something, wine, beer, tequila, whatever, tell them before they taste it what aroma, what flavor they should expect to taste. You're really going to taste a blackberry in this. You're really going to be able to taste the sort of dried fruit, apricot flavor. You're really going to be able to taste the caramel, the vanilla. They'll taste it, no matter what's in it.
Right.
No matter what it is, it'll be in there for them. All the sensory cues from something as con artistic as telling somebody what they're going to taste through what color something is really do impact what flavors somebody reports being able to perceive.
If I really wanted to have fun, I could say that there's a slight hint of monkey urine.
You could, and you know, there are some there are certainly classes of white wines that do have a little bit of a ureic character to them, and that's not a fault. Some of them mean to taste like that, but if you kind of zoom in on that, sensorially speaking, that is all you'll perceive, and it becomes a less than pleasant experience depending on what you're into.
John was just being entirely creative coming up with monkey urine. He had no idea that it actually bore some truth.
And then I broke the joke. I apologize.
No, actually, some of the stuff I drink tastes like it.
It's because you have to spend more than $6 on a bottle.
That's right.
Adam, let's get into the science here, because I guess I just don't really understand it. You know, what is the most complicated scientific process between, fermentation or distillation, or maybe we should just go to the drinks, you know, like a scotch or beer or wine?
Well, most complicated is a tough. It's a tough one to answer, because one of the things I wanted to do in the book was, in a weird way, this is going to sound strange, but I'll explain it. Make everything complicated. I really wanted to get at how much science and technology was behind the simple but profound moment of sitting at a bar and ordering a drink and taking a sip. That it really is it's the hub of a lot of human scientific history. But I will tell you, just as somebody who is in general a whiskey drinker in his spare time, I do think that distilling is fascinating as a technological achievement, because while fermentation is a natural process, fermenting is something that happens, like I said, happens without us. we took advantage of it. But distilling is something that we humans invented. You got to have a big brain with a wrinkly cortex and opposable thumbs, and I talk about this in the book, the ego, the profound chutzpah and ego to say, I can make something new here. So primarily distillation is a separation process. You're trying to break some molecules away from other molecules. And what it separates based on is vapor pressure, is evaporation. So if you put some energy into the system in terms of heat, then different molecules will boil, will turn from a liquid to a vapor at different temperatures. And you can use that to isolate some of those molecules from others. You let the vapor come up, and then you capture it, and you cool it so that it turns back into a liquid. And in doing that, if you get really precise at that, if you have the right machines, if you have the right energy into the system in different forms of heat, if you have the right metal to make the still out of, you get these chemicals like, well, any of the distillates you can think of, tequila, rum, vodka, whiskey, any of that stuff. It's all made basically the same way. There are some variations in the technology, and there are some variations in what you have to do to make it taste really good as opposed to just kind of casual moonshine, let's say. But that technology is fundamental, and it's a lot more complicated than even some of the companies that make the best stuff would want it to appear.
Huh. Well, that was going to be my next question about moonshine. I was going to say, if it takes all of this high-level thinking and science, you know, why is it that moonshine has been, you know, produced by people in the Appalachian, you know, for centuries that, you know, don't have education or teeth, for that matter?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be too mean about that. Every culture has its version of moonshine, really.
Right.
There's a great writer named Matt Rowley who's done some pretty good research on that, and he says whenever he goes to speak about moonshine, somebody, no matter what culture they're from, what their ethnic background, someone comes up at the end of the talk, takes a flask out of a pocket and says, I make this one. You know, that they've got something going on in their garage or their backyard. So I guess I would say about that just because something is, as a craft, is possible for human beings to teach each other how to do in kind of a handed down from generation to generation way, it doesn't make it any less complicated and doesn't make it any less scientific. And I would say that about almost any craft, in fact.
Yeah.
The wonders of the loom and weaving and making fabric, that's pretty complicated, and yet it's a native talent, right? It's a thing that you find across cultures in places that don't seem like they're particularly technologically sophisticated. So am I talking about a computer here? Not necessarily, although there's a lot of computer controls on the stills in big distilleries like Jim Beam or Heaven Hill, the places that make an ocean of American whiskey every year. But I would say that the underlying technology was a huge advance when it was invented. And if you believe the story that I like about when it was invented, which was in ancient Alexandria, where the library was, about 2,000 years ago, by a woman researcher who went by the name in later writings of Maria the Jewess. Don't send me letters. That's what they call her in the histories. This was a profound technological advance on the order of when somebody invented the transistor, because it represented a new way of thinking about the world. It represented a way of saying, oh, we can take control of this. We can separate one thing from another that didn't used to be separate. We can do new kinds of chemical analysis that we didn't know how to do. We can underhand, we can apprehend our world in a different way. And so even though it looks like something that you'd say, oh, well, how hard could it be? I can put it together from an old water cooler in the backwoods. All I need is a fire and a source of water and some sugar. But, you know, there was a time when people didn't know how that worked, and somebody had to invent it.
Oh, it's also fascinating. And also, you know, the moonshine has made this recent, you know, it's been rediscovered and is now very scientific and very sort of highbrow from what I've read in a couple of articles.
It is a strange thing. It is possible to get, sometimes they sell them as white whiskeys now. Moonshine is unaged, the way we think about it in the United States, at least, unaged whiskey. So when you get that lovely brown stuff in a bottle of, I don't know, Wild Turkey or Jack Daniels, all the color in that comes from the years that it's spent in a barrel. That comes from the wood. When it comes off the still, it's perfectly clear. It's clear as water. And the thing about that is, if you're a small distiller, you don't have the economics, the money, and the time to wait for that aging process to take place. So you distill something in a couple of days, and then you have this product. And then you have to wait for 10 years before you can sell it. Or you can do what you can to create a market for the idea of a moonshine or a white whiskey, that that has its own flavor characteristics, and maybe people want to taste something that tastes just like that. And some of them can be very good, but it is a there are some economic incentives to sell unaged whiskey as well.
And we're speaking with Adam Rogers, who is the author of a fascinating book, Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, moving from the sommeliers in Boston and wine and everything, let's go to bourbon. So I have these friends from Kentucky. So, oh, you know, this bourbon is held in this cask that, you know, this French woman made love to on, and it came from Chile, and it's very special, and they wave, you know, all this stuff. But the best bourbons in the world, according to your book, come from places that are really chemical factories, and they're so well run, so scientific, so high tech. They're moving the molecules, they're putting these things together, and they have nothing to do with these wonderful stories that people tell about their bourbons from Kentucky.
Well, not nothing to do. And I would say not only the best bourbons, but all the bourbons. There are some small craft distilleries around the country that are working on various brown liquors. You can find them. But the vast preponderance of the bourbon and rye that you see on the shelves of a liquor store come from, I guess they're up to 8 distilleries. So, you know, you'll see 50 different labels, different age statements, different names, beautiful designs on the labels, different shaped bottles, but 8 distilleries. And those distilleries, I say that not to denigrate the product, because some of those are really excellent. You might have seen an article recently. It was in the Daily Beast, but it was something that the booze community has known about for a long time, but it wasn't general knowledge, that almost every rye currently being sold comes from one distillery. It used to be called LDI. It's in Indiana.
Right.
It's got a different name now. And they all have, you know, they have different recipes, different grain bills, they would call it. So the amount of rye and corn and wheat and whatever else varies. But they're all from the same place with different labels and different owners. And the argument for why that's dishonest is not that they don't taste good, because a lot of them really do. And it's not that they aren't made well, because they really are, because this is a place that, as I say, is much more like a factory than a couple of old guys, a couple of good old boys in the backwoods with a still. The stills that these places have are 7, 6, 7 stories tall, and all of the plumbing that runs the fermented mash into the stills and controls what comes off the still and where you keep it and whether it runs through another kind of still first before you send it to the place where it gets put into barrels and when it gets bottled. They really are. They look like, I don't say this as a criticism, they're run like sewage treatment plants. They have to be. There's a lot of technology there because they're looking not only for something that tastes good, but also for something that's consistent. Because if Jack Daniels this week doesn't taste the way Jack Daniels tasted last week, you stop drinking Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
And they can't afford you doing that.
It's like Big Macs with McDonald's. The Big Mac in St. Louis has to taste like the Big Mac in San Jose.
Exactly. Consistency. Industrialized consistency. It's really hard to do. I'll tell you, it's something that the winemakers don't know how to do. The thing that we value in wine is this particular vineyard and this particular vintage. This year was the good year. Last year wasn't. And if you really press the wine scientists, the people who study it, for why that's true, they kind of can't tell you. The winemakers don't really know how to control for that. And part of that is that they're dealing with the vicissitudes of the weather, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're dealing with changes in the way the strain of grapes grew. There are some things that are out of their control, for sure. There isn't anything that's out of the control of the people who make Wild Turkey.
No, not at all. It's very scientific. Before we go, I definitely want to talk to you about hangovers. And you mentioned in the book that everything that anyone has ever told you about hangovers is wrong. Can we talk about that?
Sure, pretty much. It's a real bummer, isn't it? I bummed people out with that chapter, and I didn't mean to. But there is that thing. I think everybody has gotten it over the years. Certainly, if you were a person who drinks, you've gotten the speech, the one that they give you the day before the first night of college. Let's say, like, well, it's dehydration. Make sure to drink a lot of water. Make sure to don't mix your drinks. Different kinds of drinks. Don't have beer and wine and something else. Don't have sugary drinks. Sugary drinks are what does it. Daiquiris, you know, stay away from the strawberry frozen daiquiris. The brown liquor will do it worse to you than clear spirits will. Stay with vodka. Vodka won't give you the hangover that bourbon will or brandy will. None of that stuff. I would say the strong way I would put it is none of that stuff's true. The more scientific way to say it is none of it's proven. Nobody's ever been able to show that any of that is true. So take something like dehydration, for example, which is the classic. It is certainly the case that alcohol will dehydrate you. It suppresses a hormone called vasopressin, which is the antidiuretic hormone. It keeps you from peeing too much, that hormone.
Yeah.
And alcohol suppresses that, so when you suppress that hormone, you can understand what the results are. You do get dehydrated, but when you're hungover, first of all of your electrolyte levels have come back to normal. And if you rehydrate somebody with a hangover, they still have the hangover.
Yeah. Huh.
And the studies that show that it could be congeners, the things in a drink that are not ethanol or water, the things that make a brown liquor brown, any study that's tried to show that those hangovers are worse are dicey at best, and they tend to have very small results. The only thing that really has had any kind of scientific impact is the hypothesis that a hangover is an inflammatory response, very much like if you have the flu. And there's a lot of symptomatic overlap if you think back on what symptoms of a real banger of a hangover are. Also, there's some overlap with migraine. And so some of the drugs and some of the experiments that people have tested deal with both those. And, like, the most successful test on a drug to try to help people with hangovers, unfortunately, was on a drug that isn't available in the United States. It's an anti-inflammatory prescribed for migraines called Clotam. They have it in Europe. And that did a lot of good. You can't get it here. I tried to get it. I tried a lot of sneaky ways to get it, and everybody, my attempts were rebuffed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
To get a hold of it, yeah.
You weren't stealth enough. How about oxygen bars? Do those help with a hangover?
I mean, no. Pure oxygen does seem to help with a lot of different kinds of headaches. Nobody's really sure why. So if you're the kind of person whose hangover manifests as a headache, then possibly there'd be some help there. Also, sitting in a nice, quiet place and relaxing always helps a hangover. There are some over-the-counter, there are all those pretend remedies that you can buy at the counter of a 7-Eleven, right, where you say, oh, it's an anti-hangover. And almost all of those have never been shown in real tests to have any effect. But there are a few things you can buy over-the-counter, like on the Internet. There's a vitamin B6 analog called peritinol. There's a prickly pear cactus extract.
About the Japanese raisin tree root.
Yeah, well, so that's the one I was getting to. There's a plant called the Oriental raisin tree, or Hovenia, and it's used in the traditional Chinese medicine, to help people with hangovers. And there does seem to be, based on some very good science out of UCLA, a molecule in this stuff called dihydromyrcetin. That you can buy as an extract that does seem to affect the same receptors in the brain that ethanol seems to affect. Now, the real problem here is that ethanol is the only recreational drug people use that researchers haven't articulated a mechanism for how it works. They know how everything else that people mess around with affects the brain, but ethanol is an outlier. And this is amazing for something that we've been using for at least 10,000 years. They just have, not that they have no idea, but they haven't finished this work. And if you don't know what it's doing, if you don't know what that first drink is doing, it's real hard to figure out what that fifth drink is doing, you know?
Very interesting. I was going to mention that they do sell greasy hamburgers and French fries over the counter, and
that
works.
That's true. another remedy that has more power in the storytelling than in the science. But there is one of the symptoms of common symptom of a hangover is gastrointestinal distress. The acid levels go up in your guts, and you get nausea. You get you get that sort of just bumpy tummy feeling. And so, getting some food in your stomach, especially if you haven't eaten because you were drinking all night, can help with that. But and I know some people swear by it. I really try hard to avoid hangovers. They are nature's way of telling me that I have really messed up before. When I have had them, I tend to wear mine in my stomach. And the idea of a greasy hamburger just like, that's not happening.
Okay. Well, Adam Rogers, it's been a pleasure talking to you. The book is Proof, The Science of Booze. And from yeast and sugar, fermentation, distillation, aging, smell and taste, body and brain. And that last chapter, Hangover. It's a great book. Adam, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Thanks, Adam.
Bye.
And this is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be speaking with Joshua Wolf Schenck. There we go. He's written a book called The Powers of Two, fascinating about the chemistry of what happens when two people come together and create, really. Stay with us.
Nexus IT is proud to support Cool Science Radio and KPCW. Nexus IT provides complete cloud computing solutions to streamline and simplify your business, IT processes, and logistics. 435-487-9099. NexusITC.net.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. When we think of creative duos, we don't necessarily think about creativity, but it, as it turns out, it takes two. The dynamic behind the power of two is truly chemistry. And in his book, Joshua Wolf Schenck weaves the lives of scores of creative duos, from John Lennon and Paul McCartney to Marie and Pierre Curie to Steve Jobs and Woz, and uncover the core qualities through which creative intimacy unfolds. Along the way, he reveals how pairs begin to talk, think, and even look like each other, how the most successful ones thrive on conflict, and why some pairs flame out while others endure. Joshua Wolf Schenck, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I read your book over the weekend, found it fascinating, and I was sitting down with some friends and we were talking about your book. And I think one of the reasons that we all really enjoyed the conversation is because, well, we all, you know, have some kind of relationship with John and Paul McCartney and with the guys that created South Park. And you know, we like that whole thing. But I think one of the other reasons that we really like it is that we all talked about experiences in our own lives, and they weren't Lennon and McCartney experiences, but where we just had just a little taste of this type of relationship with someone, where when we were together with that person, we were a little smarter, a little quicker, and that's a good feeling.
Yeah, it's like you're all of a sudden you feel like you're jumping on a trampoline, or you're walking down one of those moving sidewalks. It's just things get quicker and easier, and it's also more fun, and it can be a little jarring, and sometimes can be even a little unpleasant, because you start sparring with someone, and they're bringing out your best, but it's like things are quite placid, and now, this other person is really getting under your skin. I really appreciate you starting in that place, because we're looking at eminent partners here, because they are illustrative of, great creative work, and also they're examples that we can we can tell the stories and grasp them very quickly. But ultimately, this is about working out a model of creativity that is true and makes sense in our own lives.
And there's so many elements to this process and to what is in your book. But I just want to touch on one small piece that I read, and that was the protective nature of some of these relationships. And when you talk about Matt and Trey from South Park, they're very protective of their team and in the way that they work together, and that they don't allow others to get in.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things, you start the story and you look at chemistry or electricity, where we started, and there is such a thing as creative love at first sight. It's often palpable, within moments of meeting somebody, but it takes time to develop a true partnership. And one of the things that happens as you move towards, being a we, is that there's a sanctification. There's a sense that what happens between the two of you is special, and no one else gets access to it. And that's pretty critical. That's a lot of what helps build confidence and trust and faith over time.
Hmm. Joshua, I just have to say, I read through your book and doing a little research, looking at interviews, and I kept looking for your co-writer. I mean, you are the lone genius. You're kind of contradicting your own book here by writing this book on yourself, but you must have had creative collaboration.
This is an interesting question because it goes to one of the central points of the book, which is that we first of all, I think we really neglect a collaboration generally. But when we start looking at collaboration, we think about it very narrowly as, you know, two guys in a room like doing the same thing, when in fact a lot of creative exchange depends on very distinct roles and mm-hmm. people doing very different things, which get represented very differently around the project. So I am a writer, and my name is on the cover of my book, and most of the sentences and the phrases, these are things that I typed onto my computer. Mm-hmm. But my co-creator of this book, Eamon Dolan, is my editor, and this is an absolutely critical partnership. He was there in my mind the moment I had the idea, even before that, as we, you know, hashed around ideas leading up to this. He was the official editor of record for 4 years. He bought the proposal in 2010. Now, his role is not to be on the cover of the book, and his role is, you know, he's off doing his thing while I talk to you on the phone, and that's totally appropriate. Yeah. And every field has these hidden partners, and it's the solution is not to, you know, for Eamon to be on the cover of my book or to be in this interview. The solution, though, is for us to pay appropriate attention to the person who is off camera as we try to understand creative work. So you need to understand the producer on a TV show or the COO in a business or even the assistant, you know, to a scientist in a laboratory who is, you know, playing some critical role.
Well, I'm so glad you went in that direction. That's what I was hoping for, because so what you've done is you have allowed yourself to accept collaboration and other forms of expertise, whereas I think some people who go the lone genius route are perceive collaboration as a sort of threat and therefore never benefit from the synergy that can happen when two people create together.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy, you know. I mean, it's made me better, but there is an inherent challenge. I mean, Eamon and I share a vision for a certain kind of book. We both love this question. We both wanted to reach a lot of people through our exploration of it, but we had a lot of differences, temperamental and you know, in terms of, you know, our ideas of what this ought to be, and we had to hash that out over and over again. He had to put up with me, and I had to put up with him. And, you know, there are, you know, constant threats to, you know, this sense of individual ownership and the individual ego. And the more successful something is and the more attention it gets, but, you know, the harder it is sometimes to maintain that sense of collective. It's like, who am I in all this? If you look at how John Lennon and Paul McCartney unraveled, one of the problems is that they were so identified with the other in public that they really they felt a little lost. And John got sweet-talked by this very dubious character named Alan Klein, who came in and said, I know what you did. I know what songs you wrote. And John was so flattered by this and excited that someone might recognize his individual contribution that he, you know, he signed on with Klein, who turned out to be a total disaster, not only for John and Paul, but for John himself and for the whole enterprise. So that tension is just inevitable. And one of the things I really like about the pair as a model is that it does not negate the individual and all the things that happen in an individual, and it doesn't negate the necessity of solitude and space either. But there is it shows you the relationship between the individual and the collective, which is, you know, that's where human life happens.
In fact, the individual is very important to the partnership.
Yeah, and the partnership creates the individual creates the partnership. The partnership fuels the individual, and there is this cycle that moves all the way through. And if you look at very, very highly effective partnerships that, you know, have lasted a long time, the individuals are extremely distinct, and they're often doing very distinct things within, within the partnership, even as they have this very strong collective we.
Well, this hidden partnership is fascinating, just as the words in your book came from you. It was the collaboration with your editor, and just as Vincent van Gogh, and I did not know this. I mean, he put every brushstroke on his painting, but he had a very special relationship with his brother Leo that, in fact, complimented him in such a way that made him the success that he was.
Yeah. Yeah, Theo van Gogh is sort of known, to the extent that he is known, as his brother's supporter. And you think of, some genial guy, sending checks to the mad genius artist. In fact, they were both in the art world. Theo was a prominent art dealer, had a very finely developed sense of aesthetics that had been inculcated in him by his older brother, Vincent, who he looked up to enormously. And when Vincent decided to become an artist, they were in it together from the beginning. Theo did in fact support him financially, but it was also a business arrangement. He bought his brother's work and represented him as a dealer. And there was an enormous exchange of critical ideas about what painting ought to be, introducing each other to different different schools and different aesthetics. And by the end, they both believed that they had co-created this work that bore Vincent's name.
Mm. You know, I'm wondering as I'm sitting here, when you are identifying someone that you can have as a creative partner, we say two things to each other. We work so well together because we think so much alike, or we say the opposite. We work so well together because their strengths are my weaknesses. And so how do you identify someone who... is that person?
Yeah. Well, those are the two elements, and it may seem like a paradox, but it's those are the two heads of this beast, that you need profound similarity. What I found looking at pairs is it's really uncanny. If you look at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, the degree to which they were alike, all the things they had in common, the soaring idealism. Combined with they were both pranksters. They loved hijinks. And they were both preoccupied with technology and had big dreams of what technology could do. It's almost like they're identical twins. At the same time, they're so different. One of them is this wily, charismatic guy who just could charm people into doing things that the last thing they wanted to do. And the other was a little awkward, a little bit shy, ambitious, but much more inclined to sort of burrow into his projects and stay up all night working on his electronics. And it's almost the difference is so much that they are two creatures of another species. So for people who are the similarity is often the foundation. That's often how you actually meet the person, and that's a helpful way to think about it. Within your company, who shares your values, who shares your vision, or if you're an artist, going to conferences where, the kind of work that you like is happening. But then within that, you want to look for the person who challenges you the most. And it may be that they excite you with something that's possible that you didn't realize was possible. It may be that they actually, they get under your skin and irritate you and bother you, and you just think, wow, this is exactly wrong. Well, that may be something to really pay attention to, because that may be a real source of growth.
When I think about Woz, he wanted to give those early products away when they had that credit card generator where you could spoof AT&T, who I think was in charge at the time before the divestiture of AT&T. And, of course, Steve, he wanted to sell this throughout the free and captured world. I mean, it was a complete difference in philosophy.
Yeah, and it together created a workable model for the first personal computer. So both those elements are necessary, and there was an inherent tension, and it did eventually lead to one of them, fading away from that enterprise, and then Steve Jobs had many acts to follow, but that's always there. It's there with Watson and Crick, who had different You know, they had different skills, and they also had, you know, different roles, and they went at each other relentlessly, and that trying to demolish the other's ideas. They knew that if something could withstand, you know, the fiercest criticism of their exchange, then it was worth, you know, worth pursuing.
Many of these people were brought together by what you might call coincidence. Should people actively go out and try to find a partner, try to find someone they line up with?
Sure. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think the most important thing is to have it clearly in mind that, you know, this is where, this is always necessary for great creative work, and to keep your eye out for it. And there's certain practical steps you can take, like going to, you know, these places of shared interest that we talked about. But I think it's you know, the primary thing to do is to pay attention to the way you feel in other people, in other people's company, and to, you know, to follow these little sparks where they lead.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Joshua Wolfschenk. He's the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. And Joshua, I found it interesting, you know, you talk about, you make the argument for the lone genius is no longer a paradigm that works. And yet you go back to people like Emily Dickinson, who was very introverted and introspective and spent a lot of time alone writing. But it turns out that even she sent a lot of her poems out to people to either get feedback or just to share. And I found that so interesting, as we now are in a world of social media where the collaboration may be taking place with, you know, people that we just send our stuff out to.
Yeah. Well, you know, the all of the technology, you know, of our age gives us a lot of choices for how to mediate, and you know, with every choice there's opportunities and there's also there are problems. I mean, I think people spend way too much time on email right now, and if you look at the social science of, you know, what can happen when people are, you know, two people are together. It's profound, and I think a lot of collaborators are just not in each other's presence nearly enough. At the same time, people do need enough quiet space for their temperaments, and Emily Dickinson was someone who was not uninterested in other people or relationships or, you know, human affairs. She was quite passionate, and she seems very much like what psychologists now call the highly sensitive person, who's so easily aroused that they really need a lot of time to cool off. And so she did what was really effective for her, which was to, you know, take an enormous amount of time in solitude and to conduct her relationships through her poetry and through her letters, of which she wrote many thousands.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that creative exchange is everything is not opposed to the value of solitude and the fact that, you know, many things we do on our own. A stand-up comic gets up on stage alone. You know, a CEO may have to address his board. There's no one else sitting in his chair. He doesn't have a microphone in his ear. That's totally appropriate. I mean, I'm here, you know, on my own. I don't have Eamon editing my phrases as much mm-hmm. as I'd like, and that goes to the, you know, the intersections of the many varieties of intersections and between people, and it also goes to this sort of this question of instruction. What do we do if we want more of this in our life? Well, first, I think you need to recognize that this is fundamental. This is primary. And then you need to say, okay, well, there's so many variations of the way this manifests. What's going to be right for me?
Yeah.
I think we've all observed married couples that we've known over time that start looking alike in their mannerisms, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you talk about Warren Buffett and his partner, Charlie Munger. They wear the same gray suits, the same Clark Kent glasses, the same comb-over. They have the same lurching, awkward gait. They speak the same vocabulary. They speak in, they have their own way of speaking in abbreviated forms with each other. I mean, this happens over time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a delicious little piece of social science that they're, you know, we are constantly mimicking each other, and over time, if your facial muscles are mimicking the facial muscles of your partner, they will actually, you know, take a certain shape, so people can actually come to look alike. The much bigger story is the way that we come to think alike and talk alike, and the way that we, our minds actually get organized around what we know and what our other partner knows. So it's a very crude and simplistic metaphor, but the metaphor sort of filing cabinets in the mind. So there's certain things that are just marked with the name of your partner. You know, he knows how to do that. He's good at that. I can turn to him for that. And so your mind kind of becomes, just to switch metaphors, a series of links between yourself and critical people in your life. And that is, you know, how we're organized cognitively. So the brain really can't be understood as an isolated thing. It has to be understood in its connection with other minds.
Oh, that's so interesting. Joshua, during this conversation, I just have to tell you quickly, I have a documentary you have to see. It's called Slaying the Badger. This week in Utah is a big biking week with the Tour of Utah. And this is a story of the 1986 Tour de France. And it's the rivalry between Greg LeMond and Bernard Hinault. And why I've been thinking about it is it's about that creative, the tension that is created between people that is not necessarily good, but it makes one person rise where they may not otherwise have, resulting in Greg LeMond's first victory of the Tour of France. But yeah, oh, you'll have
cool.
to see that one.
I'll check that out. I love that. I love these rivalry stories.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time, and we want to thank you so much, Joshua Wolf Shank, who has written Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Joshua, thank you for being with us this morning.
Yeah, thank you both for a great talk.
I'll just close with this, Joshua, and that's one of your chapters is titled 1+1=∞. And thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
We'll return after these messages.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801. PeakArtAndFrame.com.
I want to thank our guests on Cool Science Radio today, Andy Greenberg and Joshua Wolf Shank. Also, our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT. And you had a little tidbit.
Yeah. Last week, we spoke with Alan Gia, who's a digital security expert and CEO of the Swiss company Globe X, and we're talking about security and all of the different hacks that have been going on. Yesterday, it was reported that 1.2 billion identities have been stolen, including 550 email addresses, many social security numbers, etc. We want to mention what he told us. One, do not log into from a hotspot if you have confidential information. Two, make sure your passwords are complex. Three, do not log in from Facebook or Twitter. You're listening to KPCW Park City